From the Sky News Centre at 5, more than 40 people, around half of them children, have died after their boat sank near Greece. It's further evidence of a migration crisis gripping Europe. Annie Joyce reports.
More than a million have fled violence for a better life. The European Commission's vice president says there are limits.
We do need to make a better distinction between people who deserve international protection and people who, frankly, are just migrants looking for a better life.
The Chancellor reckons refugees should be helped near where they live.
And then they won't feel the need to make the journey across the Mediterranean.
David Cameron wants to curb migrants' benefits, but today said he'd accept alternatives.
There are a number of options that different countries, the European Commission, the European Council, are putting forward.
The migration crisis is topping the agenda for EU leaders.
The Czech Prime Minister's put forward the first alternative to David Cameron's controversial reforms to EU migrant benefits. It's been suggested the UK could impose a so-called emergency brake to cut migration numbers. A police officer and community support worker have lost their jobs following the vigilante murder of a disabled man mistaken to be a paedophile. Bijan Ibrahimi was killed in Bristol in 2013. Asda and Tesco have taken diesel prices down to a six-year low. Both supermarkets will charge just under 98p a litre, but Simon Williams from the RAC thinks they should be doing more.
The wholesale price of diesel is 5p below petrol at the moment, so really the cuts should be coming thick and fast, and we would like to see another penny or two in the next week or so.
In sport, goal line technology will be used at Euro 2016. UEFA will also employ it in the Champions League from next season onwards. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
BCFM.
Thank God it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot, Mark Wright. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, MH370, remember the Malaysian airliner that mysteriously disappeared on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing? More evidence emerging this week that the real destination was the secretive US airbase of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the Chagos Islands, which the Pentagon is leasing from guess who? Yes, from us. Questions too about local firm Rolls-Royce and whether they have been entirely honest with the families of those that disappeared. Plus, the public inquiry into the death of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko. The book he wrote, Blowing Up Russia, about the 1999 bomb attacks in Moscow. Also, his friend, exiled Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky. And Berezovsky's strange admiration for the Queen's cousin, Prince Michael of Kent. Why did Berezovsky pay the Duke over £300,000 before his untimely death in 2013? And the polonium trail leading back and forth to Moscow, could it have been laid on purpose? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, dry and often clear skies tonight. This weekend, highs of 14, dry for most of Saturday with some sunny spells. Rain coming in late afternoon. Cloudy on Sunday, generally breezy. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, plenty of wet and windy weather this week. Also some sunny spells next weekend. That's the 30th and 31st of January. Highs 11 Celsius and 40 wet and windy. I don't know quite. It's fairly wet and windy, sorry. That's next weekend. Again, At least the temperatures are up a little bit, aren't they, from earlier in the week. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, Mark Wright. Hi, Mark.
Welcome. Hi, Tony.
To the politics show now.
Thank you.
But just before we sat down here, you were telling me Cabot Ward has not long for this world.
That's right, I'm afraid. It's very sad news. It's been the city centre ward for quite a long time, obviously. Great history, great name. But Bristol's boundaries, Bristol's ward boundaries are being completely redrawn because Bristol's had huge population growth in the central areas of Cabot, Lawrence Hill, Ashley and St Paul's, and there need to be more councillors in the central areas, basically. So they've been completely redrawn, and despite my protestations and various other people's, Cabot has been abolished and some new wards have been created in its place.
So this is all for the elections in May, beginning
That's
of
right.
May this year. You say Cabot, a great name. Now, a lot of Native Americans would probably disagree with you.
Fair point. Yeah, fair point. I mean, I don't really know what to say.
Well, I mean, he found Newfoundland or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, up in Canada, he went across just a couple of years after Columbus had gone across to the Indies. Of course, the Vikings had been going along on pretty much the same route that John Cabot went for 500 years at least before that, and the Vikings had settlements in Greenland and Newfoundland since the 9th century. So, in a sense, John Cabot's discovery wasn't that brilliant. It's just that the Vikings hadn't been very good at telling everyone.
Did he pinch a few Viking maps? I wonder, Martin, there was recently some discoveries up there of Roman artifacts, and there was people, and this is over Christmas actually, saying, oh gosh, the Romans, maybe they were up in Newfoundland too. But I think, isn't it probably more likely that the Vikings had found Roman hordes and taken them?
It's more likely that the Vikings had taken Roman material there. The more interesting theory, which I have read, is that the Bristol fishermen had already discovered the Grand Banks a long time before anybody officially knew about the existence of North America. And of course, if you did, because there was a cod war against Iceland in the 1400s, and the English lost, and they didn't have access to Icelandic waters, so they'd moved. This is the Bristol fishermen had moved further west to look for fishing grounds, had found the Grand Banks off Newfoundland. And of course, if you're a Bristol fisherman or entrepreneur and you find a massive fishing stock, you don't go yippee and tell everybody. You quietly go out there and harvest it without letting anybody know. And that both Cabot and Columbus came here trying to ask around the pubs in Bristol is what is over there. And of course they were fairly cagey about it, rather than saying yes, we've discovered America. It's like no, we haven't. I mean, and also Cabot was, because he had Bristol seamen on his ship, also was led a merry dance. Like one of his expeditions never got anywhere because the seamen were making sure that it didn't. Now, I don't know whether this is true, but it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, it's a shame to say goodbye to the name for the ward as well. But Mark, you're a Liberal Democrat. You're probably quite pro-EU, am I right?
That's correct, yeah.
Because we've got two enormous great crises that the EU has brought to our door. One is the refugee migrant crisis, and the other one is the euro. Surely at some point you're going to say, well, look, this is a disaster, this, and they're not dealing with them.
Well, I think, I mean, if you, in the grand scheme of things, the EU is still a very new idea. You know, if you look at the whole of history, it goes back hundreds, thousands of years, and we're still very much in the infancy of the EU.
Well, we're crash testing it at the moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're seeing the growing pains. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind the various disasters that the United States had in its first century. You know, I mean, they had various economic collapses, they had various wars with various countries, including us, of course. Then they had a civil war. You know, I mean, all countries and great political unions have a lot of crises in their early years, and they weather them. If they weather them, they go on to greatness. And I think that these are huge tests for the European Union. I think that the European Union will come through them and will be better and stronger for it. I mean, there's no doubt, though, that the European Union does need dramatic reform in a whole swathe of different areas. The economic union that's been forced by the single currency is not currently, you know, working properly, and it's not set up right. They do need to address that if they're going to keep with the single currency. But I think they can do that, and I think they'll pull through.
Is David Cameron going to succeed in any kind of renegotiation? Because I can remember Hollande and Merkel saying to him right after the last May's general election, no, we're not renegotiating.
Yeah, I think that the European powers are looking at the opinion polls of the referendum in the UK and realising that it's on a knife edge and that there is a 50-50 chance that we will be exiting the EU. And I think they're looking at the EU's other troubles. And I think a bit of reality is starting to dawn on Ms. Merkel and Mr. Hollande. And they are starting to realise that we could be 6 months away from the Brits leaving the EU. And, in all honesty, that would be a massive, massive blow to the European Union at a time when it's already very weak. And I think they're realising that Britain needs to be given some of the things, at least, that it's asking for, most of which, to be honest, are pretty sensible. I'm no fan of Cameron, but what he's asking for, I generally agree with and I think is sensible. And if the EU can't come up with these, then unfortunately I fear that we may end up exiting. And, the Germans and the French do not want that. They really don't.
So there's no point at which you would say, what with economic devastation due to austerity and mismanagement of the euro, plus migrant, refugee horrors, that you say, actually, this is not working. We're going to have to get out of this.
Well, our issues with asylum seekers and migrants coming won't be solved or changed, really, by us leaving the EU. I mean, the Syrian refugees have just as much right to come here with or without us being in the EU, because they can turn up and simply claim asylum on the grounds of what's going on in Syria. So that simply won't change at all.
But I'll tell you what might, and that is that the mafia are making a massive amount of money out of migrants, not refugees, coming across the Mediterranean into southern Europe. And of course, once they get a foothold in Europe, then they are entitled to come to Britain.
Yes, yeah, indeed, that's entirely true. I don't think that's the biggest part of the crisis, though. I mean, if you look at the main influx that Britain had from European migration, of course, we had over 1 million come from Eastern Europe, and that has been the biggest impact. And although if we left the EU, no more would be able to come so easily, the reality is not many more are coming right now anyway, because pretty much all the ones that wanted to come here are now here, and they would be under no obligation to leave should we leave the EU, unless we forcibly deported them all, which would be a social nightmare and a disaster economically
Wouldn't it be nice if we could actually say, well, we value you as a person, rather than, oh gosh, we don't want you? It just seems to me that people are, there's the wrong attitude. People are seen as kind of liability, Martin, that governments in Europe just do not want them.
Well, that's true. In actual fact, as free market economists will tell you, we've got an ageing population in Western Europe, and without an influx of younger people to pay the taxes, then there's a potential that you won't, you won't be able to.
But we've got vast amounts of unemployed. I mean, particularly young people here, vast amounts of unemployed jobs. They can't get jobs. Young people, 18 to 25.
What you've got from Eastern Europe is highly qualified people who are prepared to work for relatively low wages. What you've got in Britain,
well, you're saying drive the wages
people
down.
Who are not as qualified as that.
So what you're saying is
it's difficult to find a job under any
circumstances. It's good to have the migrants because they drive wages down.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I think that is a real problem. If we don't have a full employment policy in Britain and the EU, then clearly there is going to be a situation where some people are losing jobs to other people who are taking them. But that's going to be the case anyway. Even if we left the EU, the same economic problems are still going to be there. I personally think there's going to be a banking collapse, and that may happen before we vote on the EU, and being in or out of the EU will be largely irrelevant if the US banking system is dragging us all down the drain. And there's no realism about any of this. A lot of the discontent with the EU in Britain is led by people who don't really understand the wider geopolitical and economic implications.
You sound
of who
a bit like a Eurosceptic to me. It's like you're saying, well, what we've done is we've farmed out some of these big important decisions to do with economics, etc., too far away from Britain, and it's the US and the Brussels that are now making the decisions to determine our future.
People in Edinburgh would say we farmed it too far away to London. Same in Dublin and in Belfast. I think the fact is that arguing about belonging or not belonging to the EU, I'm frankly agnostic. I don't think it makes much sense to try and leave. Even if we did leave, we've had UKIPers on this show, and they don't seem to understand that in Norway they pay more per head into the European budget than we do, but they don't get any say on how it's spent, and none of it's spent in Norway. And if we were to leave the EU, we would still have to pay into the EU budget. But then say, well, why would we have to pay? Otherwise, you face a tariff tariff barrier against your exports. And you've actually got to, I mean, we've just got the biggest production of cars in Britain for a very long time. It's peaked very recently. And the obvious thing that would happen if you left the EU without paying into the EU budget and doing a deal is you say, right, well, the international car companies will no longer locate in Britain. And that's a price. If it's a price you're prepared to pay not to be told what to do by Brussels, that's fine. But I think the people who work in Nissan in Sunderland would have something to say about that.
And what about the fact that the Swiss, the Norwegians and many other countries have just said, well, actually, we were happy to be a part of trade deals, but we don't want to cede any sovereignty?
Well, yes, but when you say cede sovereignty, you've got to do a deal with the EU. Even if you leave the EU, you've got to do a deal with them about how you're going to trade with them. I mean, what they're trying to do is ram the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership down our throats via the EU. Now, if Britain left the EU, would the Faragists and others sign up for the American-led Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership? They shouldn't, but they might. And the fact is, if we sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, we might as well be in the EU anyway, because that's, you know, we get it rammed down our throats either by Washington or by Brussels or by nobody. Perhaps nobody, if we're all sensible.
Mark, one of the things that irritates me, I'm not sure if it irritates you, but it's the way the mainstream media is constantly talking about the EU as Europe. They use the word Europe. They say we're in Europe or out of Europe. Well, actually, there's quite a lot of European countries that aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you obviously mentioned Norway and Switzerland and Iceland as well, of course. Martin is right. You know, the countries on the periphery of Europe still do most of their business with Europe, and they have to engage with European rules. And what it boils down to is you may not like the European rules, but do you want input into them or not? I mean, Norway has to abide by European standards and regulations in all the trade that it does with the EU. The fact that it's on the outside gives it some benefits, and Norway has got some, you know, Norway and Switzerland have got some peculiarities because, of course, Switzerland is an international banking centre and wants to hoard all of its secret gold, and Norway are currently effectively a petro economy because they're running almost entirely on oil. I think if they didn't have those specific economic situations, they would almost certainly be inside the EU because
what's
those economics.
What's the speciality that the Icelandics have got? Geothermal energy?
Yeah, indeed. I mean they're a tiny population as well. Remember, the population of Iceland is half the population of Avon. They're almost entirely, a fishing economy, except for the fact they had some banks that they grew ridiculously big and then collapsed in spectacular fashion as they, you know, didn't really understand what they were doing.
I rather like this comparison between Iceland and Bristol, not Bath as well, and because it's around about the same sort of population, and potentially, you know, I'd like to think that the city could at least make some of its own decisions in a similar way to what Iceland has done and arrest criminal bankers rather than give them honours.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I said earlier that there certainly are things about Europe that need reforming, and this issue of the European Union has been sort of gathering power to itself for the last couple of generations. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of the things that it's getting involved with now, it just simply shouldn't be involved with. It shouldn't be interfering in. And this is true of every single layer of government ever in history. All government layers and government entities have always sucked in more and more power. This is a problem with Westminster sucking in too much power from the regions. You know, it's a problem even with big cities sucking in too much power from local communities. And now it's a problem as well with Europe sucking in too much power from national countries. And we do need to look at things, and you need to constantly reassess these structures and push power back down at every level, push power back down from the EU to countries, from countries to regions, from regions to cities, and from cities to communities.
Sounds nice, but it ain't happening.
It's not happening. It hasn't happened in this country for a very long time, which is why we're extremely unbalanced at the moment. But it's long overdue, and we really do need to, you know, it needs to be done every 15 or 20 years, because otherwise the power accumulation is always up and to the centre. Always. That's the natural, you know, way things go. You have to intervene to push power out and down, and we haven't done that in long enough in this country.
Well, look, I mean, it's not exactly this week's news, but this is an article I just picked up this week from the Daily Telegraph in September 2000. The Euro Federalists were financed by the US spy chiefs. Declassified American government documents show the US intelligence community ran a campaign in the 50s and 60s to build momentum for a united Europe. It funded and directed the European Federalist movement. Documents confirm suspicions suspicions voiced at the time that America was working aggressively behind the scenes to push Britain into a European state. One memorandum, dated 26th of July 1950, gives instructions for a campaign to promote a fully-fledged European Parliament, signed by General William Donovan, head of the US Wartime Office of Strategic Services, the precursor of the CIA. The vice chairman of one of the groups Donovan was involved in was Alan Dulles, CIA director of the 1950s. The board included Walter Bedell Smith, CIA's first director, roster of ex-OSS figures, and officials who moved in and out of the CIA. The documents show the ACUE financed the European movement, the most important federalist organisation in the post-war years. This makes the EU look to me, Mark, rather like a creation of the CIA.
I'm actually not even remotely surprised to hear this for two reasons. One is because, of course, the Americans, quite understandably, are not afraid of the concept of federalism because it's the concept upon which their country is built.
Lots of people, federal is America now, though? I mean, it's again, you were saying earlier about pulling power to the centre. That's exactly what's happened in the US.
Yeah, it is, but the Americans have got a fantastic constitution, with the exception of the gun amendment, I would say. They've got a fantastic constitution which limits and lays out very strictly the powers of the federal government and has done a pretty good job, given that it's 200 years old, at maintaining that. And in many ways, we need a similar kind of attitude in the European Union. We need that kind of states' rights attitude, which has always been strong in America and has always prevented the government, federal government meddling too much in the affairs of states. We need more of that in the European Union. I mean, the other reason this wasn't really surprising at all, of course, is because the Americans were petrified about communism at that point. Half of Europe was under the communist spell, and at that point, it wasn't obvious that communism would collapse. A lot of people thought that it was, you know, a viable alternative world economic system that might turn out to be better than capitalism. You know, in the end, it didn't. But in the 50s and 60s, they didn't really know that. So it's not surprising that the Americans were very keen that the free countries of Europe should form a federal, you know, a federal setup, much like America.
There was loads of money behind this, though. I mean, it says here from the US State Department, a memo from the European section, dated 1965 in June, advises the Vice President of the European Economic Community, Robert Marjolin, to pursue monetary union, by stealth. A bit sneaky. And also, it recommends suppressing debate until the point at which adoption of such proposals would become virtually inescapable, Martin.
I think that the European Union has got two strands to it. One is, essentially geopolitical manoeuvring by elites on both sides of the Atlantic, you know, centred in Bilderberg Group, for example. And the other is the conception, the Gaullist conception, if you like, of the European Union as being a third force between the Soviet Union and the Americans. So, de Gaulle took the France out of NATO in the early 1960s, got rid of all US bases in France, and that's because, in actual fact, he was aware that the OAS that had tried to assassinate him, who were embedded within the French military, were being aided by the Americans because they weren't happy with de Gaulle's independent stance. And if you go back to
that's the film, The Day of the Jackal.
The Day of the Jackal film is the tip of the iceberg of what was going on there. And of course, in actual fact, when Britain tried to join the EU, de Gaulle was quite keen to keep them out. He famously said no twice, the reason being that he saw the British inside the EU as a US Trojan horse undermining what the EU should be about. And I think all of this history swirls around the EU. I think the real problem now is a situation where we've got the European Central Bank basically dictating policy to countries like Greece, which the people don't want. And at some point, the EU, like most institutions, has become dominated by the financial services industry and their links, of course, to the geopolitical manipulators in the intelligence services.
Of course,
and it's not surprising that people feel, you know, it's a bit out of control.
A lot of Greeks complaining, Mark, saying the Germans are dictating again.
Mm. Well, the Greeks don't have to take the bailouts, and they don't have to borrow German money. If they want, they could leave the single currency. They have chosen to stay inside, and the reality is, if you when you go to your bank manager and say that you want to borrow more money, it's him that sets the terms, not you.
Isn't it the alternative is just total economic collapse, isn't it?
Well, there's no pain-free way out of where the Greeks are. And I think people who think that there is a pain-free way out, which involves free money from other European countries, are not being realistic, because all the other... Germany, you know, is not going to front up free money in the same way that the England isn't. You know, I mean, Angela Merkel has to keep her population pro-EU and pro the project. If she were to just say to, you know, the Greek banks, oh, we're going to write off all your debts and basically give you some free money on account of how badly you managed your economy, then very quickly she's going to find popularity of the EU in her own country collapsing. And, you know, that Germany has always been the core of the European Union, and they understand that they have to maintain strong public backing in that country.
Okay, well, coming back home here to Bristol, what about there was a meeting of the full council this week, Mark, and down in Southville, some complaints about a community centre. It looks like it's going to be being closed because the Methodist Church want to sell it off for housing. I mean, that's our community resources going down the drain.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously...
I mean, why doesn't the council have a community centre? Why are they... I mean, if the Methodist Church want to sell it off, that's up to them. But surely the city council should make sure there are community facilities like that and that the council are providing them, and that someone else can't say, oh, sorry, we're selling it off, mate.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, to be fair, there are a reasonable number of community facilities in Southville. I think what has upset local people is that for many, many years, this has been one of them. You know, and they don't... And it's always been a very popular one, and they don't want to lose it. And I can certainly understand that. I mean, people would probably wave the gentrification stick at this and say, you know, this is typical. This is a, you know, nice old church, nice old community centre. Now it's going to be made into posh flats, no doubt, that people will come to and live in. But, you know... The reality is that there's a financial incentive for organisations that have got facilities like these to sell them off if they need money.
Well, there's a financial incentive for the city council to flog off all of its assets. Oh, sorry, all of our assets for luxury housing, isn't there?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the council, I think, to be fair, is fairly slow going at selling off its assets. I mean, if you speak to any of the business community in Bristol, they say, in fact, it's almost impossible to get anything out of the council. I would say quite rightly so. The council should think on terms of generations and not jump to the beat of property values on this year or that year. I mean, the local community in Southville are doing a great job of speaking up. They obviously need to put pressure on the Methodist Church as well, because they're the people who are thinking about this. The good thing that they've got in their favour, of course, is that people in Southville tend to be pretty well educated and quite eloquent and are, you know, quite good at getting what they want.
Well, equally, or possibly more politically charged, is the Malcolm X Centre, which is apparently being evicted at the end of next month. What's your take on that?
I've not been following it too closely because it's not in my ward, but my understanding is that over...
Is there going to be a siege?
The purpose is that it's going to remain a community centre, of course. What's happening is that the management company that it's currently leased to is not having its lease renewed, and the council is going to get in a new one. So it will still, from the point of view of the community, it will still be a local community centre. I think the council has looked at the finances over the last several years and decided that it's not been managed well.
The council isn't paying any full-time staff, is it, there? That's one thing I noticed in one of the news reports. So, I mean, if the council's not prepared to front the money up to make sure people are paid to manage it, I mean, it's asking for the place to be run on the cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, but part of the contract that community organisations sign when they take community assets from the council in order to manage them is that they do commit to a certain degree of financial transparency and good management, and rightly so. I mean, the public would expect that premises which are worth a lot of money and have a lot of rental value, which is often being waived. I mean, I think the Malcolm X is rent a peppercorn, so I'm not sure that they pay, you know, any money into the council in order to get it. But the council expects, quite rightly, that it's managed well, that the finances are good, and that debts aren't built up behind, you know, various financial accounts.
It sounds to me as if it's all becoming a bit more commercial there, but that's not surely what Malcolm X Centre is about. It's not about trying to make money out of people. It's about providing a facility as people pay their council tax for the public.
Yeah, I think, but there has to be, you know, good management and accounting of what's coming in and going out, and there has to be, you know, not the building up of debts. You know, the reality is sometimes community companies do get into trouble, especially if they're managing a big property. Property management is not easy. It is a skilled task, and if an organisation is not up to it, then sometimes they have to accept that they need to move on, and it's time for someone else to take the reins. I mean, I would hope that it would be, you know, it's going to be another local community group made of people from St Paul's who will come in and,
well, fingers crossed. Let's hope there isn't a siege. Anyway, let's go and look at some more stories from this week. Labour's Beckett report busts myths about why the party lost the 2015 general election. Well, there's a couple of stories we've got about that to start with on the news stories this week. Most important factors were suggested to be perceived weakness of Ed Miliband, fear amongst English voters that Labour would work with the SNP, and an association with the economic crisis under the last Labour government. Labour was also said to have failed to convince voters of its welfare and immigration policies. Martin, this is a pretty warts and all report, and it's saying you just Miliband and your party fell down on the job.
Well, we obviously didn't win, and therefore we were not happy with that. I think there are various theories floating around why that would be the case.
Well, the main one here is that Ed was the wrong guy. The voters didn't like him.
Well, that may be so, and I'm not disputing it. But one interesting fact about the general election: if 3,000 Green voters in 10 target seats had voted Labour, the Tories would have been denied an overall majority. And this is the first election that we've ever had in my lifetime where a PR election would have led to a right-wing coalition between the Tories and UKIP. Previously to that, there has never been a majority for the right in this country.
Even though we've had decades
of Thatcherism and post-Thatcherism, Mark, they never had a majority.
You're nodding away there. What's your take from this?
What Martin has said is very significant, and I've been trying to explain this. I mean, I consider myself a progressive. I wouldn't say I'm a left-winger. I'm more of a centrist, but I am a progressive. And I've been trying to explain to some of my more excitable left-wing friends that the previous election in May was the worst election for progressives in this country in literally generations, because as Martin says, it is the first time that there wasn't a progressive majority, as they call it. Like it used to be, always be that if you added together Labour, the Lib Dems, the Greens and various other parties, they actually always scored more than the Conservatives and UKIP put together. And so there was this idea that if we had PR, you know, Britain would more often than not would return, you know, centre-left governments. It would be very different. But at the last election, if there had been PR, we would currently be under a Tory UKIP coalition. And I think that we as progressives really need to chew on that and to understand what it means. Because people say, oh, you know, the left wing wasn't left wing enough, and there was, you know, too much tussling between the Green Party and Labour, and between the Labour Party and the Lib Dems. But the reality is, we were all fighting over not enough votes. The Labour Party, the Greens and the Lib Dems, we're all fighting over not enough votes.
You're saying fighting each other rather than the UKIP and the Tories?
Even if they hadn't been fighting each other, there weren't enough centre-left and progressive votes at the last election, and we need to understand why that is. Why, when the Green Party appeared to be having this great surge, which seems to have sort of fizzled out now and not really come to anything, and people thought that the Green Party would sweep up the Lib Dem and the Labour votes because the Green Party was more radical, but they didn't at all. What actually happened is the Lib Dems and the Labour Party ended up actually losing more votes to UKIP. You know, people went to reactionary parties, they went to the Conservatives. Moderate centre-floating voters, they went right. They didn't go left. And progressive voters really need to understand why that is. And I think the last several years, particularly since the crash, progressive parties have not been...
Sorry, the bailout.
The bailout. The progressive parties have not been offering what centrist and moderate voters are wanting, and the Conservative Party and UKIP have been speaking more the language somehow, and it's not entirely clear to me what the issues are, but they have been sweeping up the disaffected. And I think progressive parties, not just Labour needs to digest this Margaret Beckett report, but also the Lib Dems and the Green Party, I think need to understand that getting hysterical rhetoric about, you know, the end of days and Dickensian conditions in the streets and austerity has not attracted people to the progressive cause. If anything, it has repelled people from the progressive cause.
Martin, another important part of the Beckett report is saying that the inquiry is saying it would be difficult for Labour to win at the next general election because of changes to constituency boundaries, voter registration changes and restrictions on trade union funding of parties.
Well, it would. I mean, the system has always been rigged, and it's now going to be rigged even more shamelessly, both financially and in terms of party boundaries. Incidentally, coming back to this question of a UKIP-Tory coalition, I don't think that the UKIP voters would have been biddable in the same kind of way as Tory voters. So if that would have been a better result, in my view, than a straight Tory government, because the UKIP voters, in fact, want their cake and they want to eat it. They are, for example, they've come on this show and they say that they're against the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, for example, when they bother to think about it. And I think that UKIP have a legitimate role in our political system, and we didn't do enough to convince those people, but that's to do with the kind of social power that big capital has in our society. The idea that you should, when you're in a crisis, you should tighten your belt, that is actually really hardwired into people, not just through recent propaganda, but through right back to the 19th century. It's wrong. I've got a degree in economics. It's wrong. In actual fact, if you are in a crisis and you tighten your belt, you actually make the crisis worse. And what's happened is we've had a property bubble, which has stuffed money in the pockets of swing voters in the rigged system, and they have decided to stick with nursing for fear of worse. But there's a 5 years to go, 4 years to go now before the next election. That's every time in the world for this property bubble to burst. And when this property bubble bursts, with the fiscal position of the British government and other governments around the world, there will be no bailout, and we will then have a very stark social polarisation.
Well, David Cameron said he's not going to fight the next general election. Maybe he knows something we don't. Also on the subject of the general election, the Tory party paid Linton Crosby and Jim Messina nearly £3 million for their 2015 general election campaigns, as in the Huffington Post. The Tory party spent nearly £3 million on polling and strategy provided by American and Australian campaign chiefs in the last general election. Its final analysis of the 2015 election financing, the Electoral Commission said that £2.4 million was paid to CTF, political strategy company, run by the Wizard of Oz, Linton Crosby. Also, $369,000 on market research by Barack Obama's polling guru, Jim Messina, who vowed before the campaign he had never lost an election. Starting to look a little bit like the US system, Mark, where the more money you spend on the most ruthless election gurus, the better chance you stand of winning.
Yeah, I think you could well say that. I mean, of course, the Tories would say £3 million was money well spent, given the result. I mean, it's £3 million over the course of 5 years is pin money to them, isn't it?
Well, the Tory donors would say that, probably. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. It is. I mean, you know, we do need more reform of campaign finances in this country. This is a relatively controversial thing. I've always been a fan, actually, of mandatory state funding of political parties and really cutting down donations to political parties quite dramatically. The moment, if, for example, I would say that every political party should get £1 for every vote they receive at the general election, and that money then is open to them to spend over the next several years until the next general election. And that would take the whole, that would take all of the donation, and then you could probably ban almost all party donations, because there would be no need. You could say that's quite a decent amount of money. There's no need for them to spend any more. And then you could ban all the influence and the paying for favours and all that kind of stuff. And people would say, well, that's £50 million of taxpayers' money, but actually that's a very small amount to make a system effectively influence free of big money and big business. £50 million is not a huge amount to buy to get rid of a substantial amount of corruption effectively. I think that would be money well spent. The reality is the public doesn't like the idea. I'm not going to be putting that on my leaflets for election, to say the least, because it doesn't win any votes. But I think that is the way to remove this problem.
The Tories' election victory meant that Messina won his own fierce battle with former fellow Obama staffer David Axelrod, who worked for the rival Labour Party in the run-up to last May's general election here. Axelrod was criticised for rarely visiting Britain during the election campaign. Doesn't sound like they got very good value for money, Labour. Saw his firm paid £223,000 for its services. Martin, it just sounds... okay, so Labour spent £223,000 on Axelrod and quite a lot more, £3 million the Tories spent on Linton Crosby. It's not surprising the Tories won, is it?
Well, I think that money in politics is becoming absolutely obscene in the United States of America, where because of the Citizens United ruling by the packed Supreme Court, any amount of money can be thrown at an election campaign and you're not even allowed to know who's spending it. So people like Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers, who are billionaires, can basically chuck any amount of money at political campaigns with no accountability at all. And the funding, state funding of political parties is absolutely normal in non-EU Norway, for example. In Northern Europe, where especially countries that have been occupied during World War II, there was a determination to have a clean system in the post-war period.
So ours is a dirty system.
These reforms have never been carried through in Britain because, in Germany, the SPD is not funded by the DGB, the trade union movement. It's funded through subventions from the state, and the trade unions spend their money on trade union stuff. They don't spend it on political stuff.
Yeah,
and that's actually the norm in Northern Europe.
Now,
but it's not the norm here. We're not actually as badly off as the US, where you've got to be a millionaire before you can even think of running. Nobody can run unless you're a millionaire, and I include Bernie Sanders in that. I don't know how much he's worth, but it's a lot more than I'm worth.
Okay, Tata Steel, Port Talbot is facing the bulk of over 1,000 job losses. We started talking about the EU, didn't we, which the precursor of that was the EEC, and before that it was the Coal and Steel Union of Europe. So we're now at the point where Britain's steel industry is falling to pieces. More than 1,000 jobs are to go at Tata Steel plants, mostly in South Wales. They said 750 jobs would go in Port Talbot, while 200 support staff elsewhere would be axed. Other job losses include 15. Well, hang on, it's only 15, so let's forget that for a minute. But it does look, Mark, doesn't it, this is the beginning of the end of steel, with a lot of criticism of central government for saying, well, things like Royal Navy contracts, they're just buying the cheapest steel they can. Rather than British steel. We don't see this as a strategically important industry anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's quite sad. If anyone who's ever been on the train to South Wales, of course, you go past the Port Talbot Steelworks, you see all the flames blowing out at the top and all that kind of stuff. It looks very dramatic. It's very sad. The reality is, of course, we're now in an intensely internationalised world. It's very easy to buy steel from countries like China, India, effectively second world countries, Brazil, places like that, which you've got much lower costs. They're much nearer to where the ore is being mined. They can produce the steel, and these days it's quite good. I mean, it used to be that no one would touch Chinese steel because it was dodgy as you like, and if you wanted a proper good quality steel girders, you only bought from Britain or Europe. But now the quality is very good coming from places like China.
Is there a case for the government to do anything here, would you think?
I don't know. I don't know the details of this. One thing is true is we cannot support...
Well, Tata are losing, I think it's over a million a week. So
yeah,
they can't survive.
No, indeed. I mean, and we cannot perpetually support businesses which are no longer competitive simply because it can be done vastly cheaper in other parts of the world. I mean, what certainly
the Chinese
should be done,
are supporting theirs, aren't they? They are supporting theirs so that the Chinese can sell a very low price steel on the market.
I mean, arguably the Chinese are supporting theirs indirectly by the sort of government stimulus of huge amounts of construction work, which is chewing up all of the product that's produced from Chinese steel. But, I think the best thing that the government can do is can look at the people who are being laid off and make very serious efforts to get them back into other jobs in the local areas. I mean, the reality is, this kind of production, the production of raw materials, is something which Northern European countries are really not competitive at anymore.
So
it needs to be moving up the value chain.
Okay, so this is really just in a certain degree of inevitability here.
I think it is, unfortunately.
Okay, so before we hear from Martin on the collapsing steel industry, let's go to Prime Minister's questions, where Jonathan Edwards, put a question to the Prime Minister, who apparently he's a big fan of the British steel industry. He says, I want a strong British steel industry, says David Cameron. And let's see what Jonathan Edwards has to say about it.
Jonathan Edwards!
Mr. Speaker, the UK government is a cheerleader for China to be awarded WTO market economy status because it wants the City of London to become a major trading centre for the Chinese currency. MES for China would make it nigh on impossible to impose tariffs on Chinese steel despite its dumping strategy. Is this not a classic case of once again a Westminster government putting the bankers of London before manufacturing workers in Wales and the rest of the UK?
I have to say, I think the Honourable Gentleman is wrong both on content and on approach. The two issues are separate. There are market economies that Europe still puts dumping tariffs on. We actually did that recently with America, and we've done it in the past with Russia. So I think we should take these two issues separately. We should continue to pursue robust action against China, which is exactly what we're doing, based on the merits. But in terms of a closer relationship, trading relationship with China, I want to help those Welsh businesses, including companies like Airbus, to break into Chinese markets and make sure we get the best for British jobs, British manufacturing, British exports. That's what we want in our relationship with China.
Well, I mean, the reason why the Chinese are exporting at less than costs of production, you could call it dumping, is because the alternative is to close down effectively, you know, modern steel plants which you've just built. And you don't do that. Nobody does that. You carry on producing and selling as long as...
Yeah, you're selling your steel virtually for free, then?
Well, it doesn't matter, because the alternative is losing all the sunk fixed costs you've put into it. And that is why there is a deflationary tsunami coming from China, because they are not going to stop producing steel, even if they're losing money, because it doesn't make sense. We wouldn't do that either if we were in their position. The real problem over many
decades...
Yeah,
but we are doing it.
Well, we are doing it at the minute, but Tata, because if it was in the public sector, we'd probably be, you know, Tata being a private business and making their own decisions, because they can move stuff around the world. If it was British Steel as it used to be, they can't relocate, so it would be a bit different. But the real problem is that we've now got, there's not been an industrial strategy in this country for years. There was, you know, during the Thatcher era, they boasted that we don't have an industrial strategy. They used to mock it as picking winners, as they called it. The market will decide. Now, in actual fact, serious countries like Norway, for example, have an industrial strategy. The number of people employed in manufacturing industry in Norway, the proportion of people employed in manufacturing industry, has gone up in recent decades. That's the only place that I know where that's happened, and that's because they've got an industrial strategy. They took their oil, we had oil in the North Sea, and they used it to reinvest and retool their small and medium enterprises. We don't do that stuff. We leave it to the market. We leave it to Tata. We leave it to somebody else. And there's never been a philosophy of planning from, you know, I'm a socialist. I believe in planning. Free markets don't always come up with the best solutions.
British people are proud of colonialism and the British Empire, a poll finds. This is the Empire's, the British public are generally proud of their country's role in colonialism and the British Empire, according to a new poll. I think this has been commissioned because of the calls in Oxford by some of the students there, particularly foreign students, to get rid of the statue of Cecil Rhodes. Martin, I'm not sure what you know about that, but at its height in 1922, the British Empire governed a fifth of the world's population and a quarter of the world's total land area. But its legacy divides opinion. Common criticism of the empire included policies causing millions of famine deaths in British India, running of brutal detention camps in occupied territories such as Kenya, the massacres of civilians by imperial troops. The British Empire was also a dominant slave trading power until the practice was outlawed in 1807, after which the empire played a key role in ending the practice internationally. The YouGov found 44% were proud of Britain's history of colonialism, while only 21% regretted that it had happened. 23% held neither view, Mark.
Yeah, it's a very interesting result, actually. I mean, my personal opinion would be that I neither regret it nor celebrate it. I think the history of empires and colonialism is actually very long and very complex, and I think it's a lot more complex than just, oh, it's evil, or, oh, isn't it great. I mean, for example, one of the favourite things that historians love to talk about is, you know, what did the Romans do to us? Of course, the Roman Empire was a great imperial colonial power, which had a dramatic effect on Europe over, you know, with a history that had repercussions for thousands of years. But actually, when you look at that now, I mean, looking back with long, you know, eyes on the issue, 1,500 years after it ended, most historians would say probably the Roman Empire was, on balance, a beneficial thing for Europe in its aftermath. Part of the problem with the British Empire is that it's way too soon to be able to have an objective view of it. There are still people around who were on the receiving end of some of the very unpleasant things that the British Empire did. I mean, there are still people around you know, who are willing to say positive things about the empire. I mean, in India, it's quite interesting, for example. I mean, in schools, they learn that the British Empire was a horrible thing and that democracy started the day the British left. But if you speak to some of the older people in India who actually lived under the British Empire, actually, it's not that difficult to find people who say, well, you know, in reality, for the man on the street, things haven't changed a great deal. Mm. You know, the only thing that's changed is, you know, who it is that's barking the orders and treating us badly. And, you know, there are people who are willing to say that the British did do some good things in the areas when they went, you know, they
built. I mean, there's quite a strong argument to say that many of these countries which gained their independence weren't, Martin, really allowed to be independent, isn't there? I mean, things like the assassination of Lumumba and, you know, when there was a genuine, in Africa, then when there was a genuine local political movement, a sort of popular political movement, quite often the person would be allowed to sort of take over for a while and they'd be moved out of the way and some kind of puppet moved in. And also, of course, there's this whole business now of the kind of economic colonialism from the IMF.
Well, that's right. I mean, we still see the pattern of the core of the world economy dominating the periphery in terms of forcing policies on people that they don't really want or need. I think there's also a bit of delusion. I mean, the Kenya case, it's interesting you should mention that, because Caroline Elkins, as a US academic, did a study about what Britain did in Kenya in the 1950s, and she concluded that up to 250,000 people were tortured to death, literally tortured to death, by British National Service people. That's in the 1950s, and some of the people involved in that are still alive. So it's not actually something that's... and that was one of the biggest atrocities of the whole of the British Empire.
But of course, we don't need to have an empire to do that. I mean, look what the Americans did in Iraq.
Well, indeed, and we're still doing these things
exactly.
I mean, we're under another label. So, I think when we were talking earlier about having a kind of right-wing majority at the last election in Britain, and this is part of to do with the cultural power of myths about the past, which are very difficult to challenge because they are embedded in people's view of the world. And we all know that it's very hard to change one's view about anything. Those who see the British Empire as a, by and large, you know, as somebody said, the empire in which the sun never set and the blood never dried, and I suppose I would count myself as one of them, they're not going to change their views. And those who see it as a largely positive thing, and I mean, like Niall Ferguson, who the British historian, who actually encourages the US to adopt an openly imperialist policy because he thinks that imperialism's a good thing. He's on the other side of the fence. But it's a very, very... the British at the moment, British military personnel are in Saudi Arabia helping the Saudi military, using British bombs, British planes, to bomb in Yemen, where up to 8,000 civilians have already been killed. The Yemeni army, which is split, have some missiles which they're able to fire into Saudi Arabia, and they've hit various air bases. And as I said on this last week's programme, those British military personnel, if the Yemeni army killed them, well, I'm not going to weep any tears about that.
Well, certainly, I would. My assessment of it is Britain were for several hundred years, certainly up till the Second World War, roughly the bullies of the world. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I suppose, is represented by this poll here. But whether we educate our young people successfully in historical fact, really, and that was something that came up, and the possibility or otherwise of doing that at Prime Minister's Question Time again. And this is Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron talking about education grants.
Well, I'm pleased to say, Mr. Speaker, that Liam is actually trying to be a maths teacher, which might be able to help the Prime Minister, because he did say he was earning £25,000, which is more than £21,000, if that's a help. In 2010, his government In 2010, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister's government trebled tuition fees to £9,000, defending it by saying they would be increasing maintenance grants for students from less well-off backgrounds. They're now scrapping those very same grants. They used to boast about them being increased. Where is the sense in doing this? Why are they abolishing those maintenance grants?
The sense in doing this is we want to uncap university places so as many young people in our children, in our country, who want to go to university can go to university. And that's what we're doing. And before too much shouting from the party opposite, when they were in government, it was Labour that introduced the fees and loans system. Given this is the week we're meant to be learning the lessons of the last election, let me read a lesson from someone, frankly, I rather miss, Mr. Ed Balls, who wrote this week in the Times Higher Education Supplement, and he said this: we clearly didn't find a sustainable way forward for the financing of higher education. If the electorate think you've got the answers for the future, they'll support you. And I would say, in all honesty to the Labour Party, when they were in government, they supported fees and loans. When we were in opposition, we made the mistake. We made the mistake that they did. If you want to be on the side of aspiration, if you want to be on the side of more university students, if you want to help people make the most of their lives, the system we've got is one that's working, and the numbers prove it.
And what he's done there, Martin, is laid the blame firmly at the door of the Labour Party for starting this whole fees and loans system.
Well, I think there's an element of truth in that, I have to say. The new Labour era was one in which we accepted the Thatcherite consensus about the way the economy worked and the way society worked. And then you pay the price for that in the long run, is that you've not made your case sufficiently robust. And you are tainted by being too close to what we should have never have accepted.
Mark, one of the big things that people are going to look back at the coalition government, which your party was involved in from 2010, is the way that students are now saddled with this massive amount of debt, aren't they, in order to actually get enough education to contribute to society and get a decent job?
Well, the point I would make is that if you look at the repayment scheme that was brought in 2010, it is effectively a graduate tax, because poorer students who don't get high-paid jobs effectively don't pay it off, and then it gets written off when they're 50, and the better-off students have a higher rate of interest, which means that they end up paying back more. There were plenty of people who, when it switched, although it was a tripling of fees, when it switched to the new system, ended up paying less, particularly the people at the bottom end of the scale. And I think on balance, you know, it wasn't ideal, to say the least, and obviously it goes without saying that the aftermath of it was a terrible, terrible political price that the Lib Dems had to pay for that. But on balance, the scheme that it replaced was also not very good, and it certainly fixed some issues there.
Listen, I want to just end with one final story here. Government is accused of waging war on Parliament by forcing through key law changes without debate. Martin, this is Oliver Wright in The Guardian, I think. It's in The Guardian. They're basically saying they're using statutory instruments more than they've ever done, and actually some of the really major legislation is now not getting debated.
Well, that's right, and I think we're also the redrawing of the constituency boundaries is extremely sinister, and the collapse of the people registered to vote, very dangerous.
This is what the most sort of headline here, Mark Wright, is George Osborne forcing through his £4 billion of cuts to tax credits using statutory instruments. I mean, this is not democracy.
Well, indeed it's not, although the Lords, and I think I absolutely back the Lords in what they did when they voted down the statutory instrument change on that, and I think they were right to do that, and if George Osborne wanted the Lords not to step in on that, then he should have put it through as a finance bill.
Okay, sorry to cut you short, but time.